My name is Jason South. I'm a triple major in physics, mathematics, and philosophy. And today we're going to be going over loop quantum gravity. The objectives of the talk will be to analyze current physics models, explain and try and answer why we need a unified theory of these models, present the key features of loop quantum gravity, and question the verifiability of the theory. In analyzing the current models of physics, it seems like we almost live in two universes that are completely separate from one another. We have Einstein's theory of relativity, which governs the macroscopic level at very high velocities, very large masses, and very large scales. Then at the same time, we have quantum mechanics, which dictates very small masses, high energy levels, and extremely small scales of space and time. And both of these are very different schemes of nature. Special relativity is trying to formulate what happens to objects as one moves and approaches the speed of light. And we find that time tends to dilate, length will contract, and mass, energy, and momentum will fluctuate. And so the observations made between the observer and the one being observed will be very different from one another. General relativity was a way to incorporate these contractions with gravity itself. And what Einstein found was that gravitation is a curvature of space and time. And this diverged from Newton's view that gravitation was just a force. Now, the interesting thing about this is the background itself, because there's a common misconception about general relativity that because it's a curvature of space and time, there has to be some sort of fixed background that's actually being curved. The common analogy is that of a bowling ball on a trampoline. And the problem with that analogy is that as good as it is at allowing one to view the implications of general relativity, it's not necessarily an accurate analogy because one has to assume the fixed background, the trampoline. And how general relativity operates is that space and time is created by this curvature. Space-time itself is produced in this curvature. So the theory is not background dependent, it actually produces the background. We can think of space-time almost as a charge of matter in a way. So we can see the divergence between Einstein and Newton here. Newton had to assume a fixed space and time background. He needed an arena in which he could work. And we can see that from the derivatives of just basic Newtonian mechanics of forces equal mass times acceleration. We can find acceleration by taking the derivative of velocity with respect to time, or derivative of momentum with respect to time. And so we have to assume a fixed background of space and time to deal with. And we also see this with the second derivative of x with respect to time. Einstein, on the other hand, his entire theory of general relativity can be summed up with this equation, r mu v minus 1/2 r g mu v plus alpha g mu v is equal to kt mu v. And what this says is that the r mu v minus 1/2 r g mu v is the curvature of space itself that's produced from matter. The plus alpha g mu v is actually the cosmological constant which he put in by hand. And this was to offset the curvature that would take place and all of matter falling toward the center of the universe. And so, because this is the equation for a static universe. The kT mu v actually represents a matter energy density. So from this equation, we can literally define curvature as the localization of matter and energy in a given volume. And you can see the pictures here again, Newtonian's fixed space versus Einstein's dynamic space-time. Now, quantum mechanics is completely different. Einstein's theory predicts a universe that's very smooth, very deterministic in a lot of ways. However, on a quantum mechanical level, space is not like that at all. It's a chaotic, violent, and non-continuous place. And I enjoy this picture because of the magnification. You can see that off in the distance there, you have a smooth representation of space, but then as you magnify it, you can see that it's just pure chaos once you get to these scales. Quantum mechanics also, with the de Broglie wavelength, showed us that matter interacted or consisted of waves. So the interesting thing about this equation is Planck's constant is equal to approximately 6.63 times 10 to the negative 34th joules per second, or joules times second. And so if we flip the wavelength to get wavelength is equal to h over momentum, we find that the momentum has to be extremely small in order to get a measurable wavelength, which we already knew. But the wavelength of a car, for instance, would just be so small it would be immeasurable. And we'll find out later that in quantum or loop quantum gravity, it would be impossible to measure. It would be logically inconsistent to ask for a measurement. And then the Schrodinger equation is basically an extension of this. It's an energy conservation equation. So on the left-hand side, we have energy is equal to the kinetic energy plus the potential energy, where psi is the wave function that we're all used to seeing. One of the implications about matter being waves is that we have to deal with these probabilities. The uncertainty principle falls out of the Fourier transformation. It literally just falls out of that matter. And so the idea behind the uncertainty principle says that the product of the uncertainty of position and momentum would be greater than or equal to h bar divided by 2. And so since it is a product, we find an inverse proportion between the certainty in position versus the certainty in momentum. As one goes up, the other one has to go down dramatically. And we find this also with energy and time. Since these are probabilistic waves, to ask with certainty where something is doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. You can say, well, where is it between a certain bound A and B? But if you want any more than that, then you tend to run into problems. The final aspects of quantum mechanics, and really this goes into quantum field theory as well, is background dependence. So whereas Einstein's theory of general relativity needed matter to create space and time, in a certain sense, so space and time is a byproduct of matter, and there would be no space-time if we didn't have this curvature. Quantum mechanics necessitates a background, and quantum field theory also necessitates a background in which particles can jump in and out of existence and where the uncertainty principle can reign. So we have these two different views of nature, and it seems like they work pretty well separately. If you want to launch rockets to other planets, or if you want to figure out maybe the rotation of the universe or something to that effect, you can use Einstein's general theory of relativity, and that'll tell you pretty much all you need to know. So this works for large objects and low energy, and by low energy, I'm speaking of the localization of the energy. The galaxies that are dealt with and the stars which are dealt with have a large amount of energy, but at the same time, they're distributed over a large amount of space. Whereas quantum mechanics deals with extremely small scales. Angstrom, 10 to the negative 10th, I believe, of a meter. You know, these are extremely small scales, and because of the small scales, they have extremely high energy. A prime example of that is the top quark, which is 172 GeV, approximately. So it's a lot of energy localized in a small space. So why do we need to unify these two if they work so well separately? Well, the first answer is that having two models of the universe seems to be a little bit problematic. It's a little bit sloppy. We live in one universe, so it seems to make sense that we would have one law governing that universe. But the other answer is that there are objects which fall into the categories of both relativity and quantum mechanics. Black holes are a prime example of that. We have extremely dense particles, but they're extremely small. They're small enough for quantum mechanical effects to take over. So if we want to formulate these, we have to come up with a theory unifying these. The origin of the universe itself. Depending on how far back you rewind time, you get degrees of 10 to the 27th Kelvin, or spaces of 10 to the negative 43rd of a second, 10 to the negative 35th of a meter. And these are extremely small, but since they have such a high density and high energy associated with them, in order to answer these problems, you would have to have a unifying model. Space-time itself is also a problem because, as we've gone over, general relativity says that space-time is a production. It's not fundamental, whereas quantum mechanics and quantum field theory have to assume a fixed background. And so in order to really come up with a theory of space-time, one has to unify these theories. And this is where loop quantum gravity comes into play. It says that space-time is discrete and granular on the very basic levels. And it turns out that the smallest possible length you can have is 10 to the negative 35th of a meter, which is extremely small. And so this scale here tends to represent that. 10 to the negative 12th of a centimeter, space is fairly smooth. 10 to the negative 30th of a centimeter, starts getting choppy, and then 10 to the negative 33rd of a centimeter is just complete chaos. It's a frothy foam almost. And the reason for this is because one can actually link the uncertainty principle with general relativity. General relativity says if you introduce enough energy into a small enough location, you'll get a black hole. By the same token, the uncertainty principle says that in order to measure anything, you have to add more energy into the system. And so the system becomes more uncertain depending on what parameter you want to use. Now, if space is discrete, then time itself must be discrete. If we have the smallest possible length, and we know that the speed of light is as far as one can go, or as fast as one can go, then all we have to do is divide one by the other, and we get 10 to the negative 43rd of a second for time. And that's the smallest amount of time we can have. So, according to this model, space itself is quantized. And much like the energy levels of the atom, where you can't just pick any energy level you want, you can't just pick any arbitrary length of space you want. It has to be a multiple of 10 to the negative 35th of a meter or 10 to the negative 43rd of a second. Which is an interesting idea that space-time itself is discrete. Now, the loop in loop quantum gravity actually comes from Faraday lines, the notion that if you have a single charge by itself, the lines will loop on themselves. And this is exactly what loop quantum gravity proposes for space. If you have a certain node, which we'll talk about in a couple minutes, then space-time tends to loop from this node and is produced by it. So space-time itself isn't fundamental. And we can see that this is the basic picture of space and time according to loop quantum gravity. Space-time is made of spin networks. And so what we have are these nodes, which are quanta of space, basically, and then we have the spin, which we're used to from regular quantum mechanics. And this is a relationship between the nodes, the spin. Now we have an area that can be computed from the distances from one node to another, which makes space purely relational, just as relativity said. At the same token, or by the same token, it turns out that area is the fundamental value here, that length itself isn't even the fundamental value on this level, it's the area between the nodes. So to ask what is between the nodes, literally the creation of space-time. And to ask what is outside of the network, for instance, here, is just a nonsensical question. Space is thought of as a field in relation to this theory that emanates from these nodes and these spin networks. And this is what a spin foam would look like. So again, we would have our spin network, which creates space here. And then because of the uncertainty principle guiding it, we would have these wild fluctuations, which occur because they'd be completely probabilistic. And so these fluctuations get stacked on top of one another. And so you can see the progression of time is the stacking of one space quanta on another. And so this is what space-time, according to loop quantum gravity, looks like at its most fundamental level. And the interesting thing about it is that it does come up with a unification of Einstein's general theory of relativity and quantum mechanics on the space-time view, because it gives you space-time which is created, but it's dependent on certain values. So in one sense, space-time is completely originated by objects, but on the other sense, it's necessitated by the spin network and the values of the quantum numbers involved. Now, avenues for verification of the theory. The problem with this is, first of all, it's theoretical physics, so that's going to be the first problem. Theoretical physics, by definition, can't be verified by experimentation yet, or else it wouldn't be theoretical physics. The energy scales we're dealing with are on the order of 10 to the 19th GeV. And to get an idea of what that means, if you wanted to test that, you would have to have a particle accelerator the size of our galaxy, which is about 80,000 light years across. The top quark is 172 GeV, and we have to have CERN and Fermilab to try and find that. So 10 to the 19th is a little bit large. Now, it's not saying that the theory itself cannot be tested or can't give us things to look for. There are a couple things that could be looked for if the theory is correct. First, if space is discrete, then there should only be certain dispersions which could take place. The angles that would be needed, if they were smaller than the smallest area, then you would have to throw them out. So the dispersion relationships themselves would have to be quantized in a way. Lorentz invariance would also be violated. The notion that the laws of physics are the same in all inertial frames would really be problematic if space and time is granular, because you reach a point where one inertial frame is not equal to the other, primarily the macroscopic versus the microscopic. But we have to remember that these are if-then statements, and just if we have the form if P then Q, because we find Q does not necessarily mean that P is true. So that's an introduction into loop quantum gravity, and at this point I'll open it up to questions.
Okay, thanks, Jason.
So that weird graph you had, does that mean like as this time go on, like all space just fluctuating rapidly?
Yeah. The notion behind it is that these basically stack on top of one another. And so space at its fundamental level is not continuous. You know, the uncertainty principle guides, and we know from the particle physics that we've taken, a little bit of particle physics we've taken, that one can violate conservation laws as long as you're smaller than the uncertainty principle. So if the uncertainty of time is 10 to the negative 18th, as long as you're smaller than that, you can have whatever kind of.
Any other questions?
So, I guess I'm kind of confused when you have the discrete packets of space.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of confused at how a particle moves across that. I mean, I realize when at our macroscopic scale, obviously just a smooth transition.
Right.
But if you have something that's pretty darn close to the discrete values, is it going to be bumping around, or what's
the effect? The thing is that I mean, this level is so small that this is where general relativity comes into play, that if you were to have a particle this size, it would be so dense that it would be a black hole.
Oh.
And so, I mean, you're dealing with 10 to the negative 35th of a meter, and the diameter of an atom is, what, 10 to the negative 10th?
Yeah.
So, okay. I mean, if you got down to this level and you were a particle, you'd be a black hole, and there'd be no spin work network to deal with anymore.
Yeah.
You'd be gone.
Have there been tests of Lorentz invariance?
Well, they tried to. As far as Lorentz invariance go, I'm not sure. I know that as far as the dispersion with the photons go, they tried to analyze gamma ray bursts, and they said that it should be off by a really small percent.
The timing of the burst arrival?
Yeah. Well, yeah, the dispersion and everything.
Dispersion,
so the timing,
radiation from the gamma rays.
Right, it should be off by just a tiny amount, and they haven't found anything. But the measurement is so small that I think uncertainty would actually play into that.
Okay,
good
questions?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
All right, so if not, let's thank Jason again.